Telecast.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to this week's Telecast. My guest this week is Benjamin Field, executive producer at Deep Fusion Films, as we discuss the issues and the ethics around artificial intelligence in TV and content production. Welcome to Telecast, Ben. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, thank you.
Great
for that
to see you.
Lovely welcome.
Yeah, well, great to see you, and thank you for coming in the studio. First of all, tell us about Deep Fusion Films.
Deep Fusion Films is predominantly an unscripted production company based in Wales, and we set up in order to take advantage of that myself and co-founder Jamie Anderson had developed over time, sort of working on previous productions at other production companies. And we found the opportunity to come together and start to sort of really take the bull by the horns and shape that unscripted production entity in sort of in a really ethical way, so that, you know, because we've been leaders of that field for a little while, and we didn't really want to see AI be misused in production. And so we thought if we led the way, then there was a chance that actually, you know, the world would be a more ethical place, shall we say.
Okay, well, there's lots of opportunity for it to be an unethical environment, and we can talk about that in a second. But so just expand a little bit in terms of your experience using AI in production and how you've used it and perhaps where you've decided not to use it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a very, very, very good place to start. So my first run-in with AI was very accidental, really. I never intended for this to be a route that we took. So I was developing a documentary about Gerry Anderson, the Thunderbirds pioneer, whilst I was at the Format Factory. And I approached Jamie and said, you know, Jamie being Gerry's son, and said, you know, are you interested? What have we got? What could we do? And he presented the idea that there was 36 hours of unheard audio archive that, you know, had never really been fully used for anything. And it would form the basis for a really interesting documentary about sort of, you know, Gerry's life, his private life that he'd never really talked about. And one of the problems we had with that was that obviously it's audio and we were making a feature documentary and not a radio show. And it was just at that time that the deepfake Tom Cruise came onto TikTok, you know, eating a lollipop or whatever it was he was doing. And so I got Jamie on a Zoom call and said, you know, how do you fancy resurrecting your dead dad? Which is not always the best opener for a conversation, but fortunately Jamie was quite up for it. And so we started exploring how that would work. Now, we had no idea how deepfake worked. I knew somebody who was sort of very, very good at VFX and CGI and been dabbling in AI for a while. So I rang him and I rang Christian and said, you know, how do we do this? And so we looked into the you know, the pitfalls and how we might get around them. One of the major ones being that deepfake doesn't actually, it can't talk. And that still remains one of the major problems today, but I'm sure we will probably touch up on that a little bit later. And so we got round those problems, and by the end of it, we'd made a feature doc with deepfake at the heart of it that a lot of people said was very good. And most importantly, everybody said was probably the most ethical use of deepfake they'd seen, which I think was really important for us, because I think there is a distinction between what appears on social media and what can appear on television or film. And for us, it was very important in those very early days to sort of draw that distinction between the authentic and the inauthentic, and making sure that what we were doing didn't cross that line, because we didn't want to lie to the audience. You know, trust and truth is very, very important in a documentary, and we didn't ever want to lie to our audience. So, you know, in terms of what we did do versus what we didn't do, we were so careful in that the audio that we had was recorded on tape, and it was, you know, not particularly great quality. And it was I think the leading voice synthesizer or voice synthesis company at the time was ReSpeecher in Ukraine. And we spoke to them and said, look, you know, could we train an AI on Gerry's voice and then remake those tapes? Could we do them again so that we had a clean audio track? And they said, yes, we can, and or yes, we could. And we looked into it a little bit further, and it was you know, within our budget to do that. But we then decided that we wouldn't do, because actually the intonation might differ in, you know, in the new version. And if it did differ, how much of that then was truly authentic? Because obviously when we talk, the intonation is very, very important. So we didn't want to get to a point where we could ever be sort of accused of lying purely by sort of misinterpreting, you know, a breath or a pause or a joke or a half-truth. Or, you know, I didn't want to be at a point where we were having to make decisions on what it was that Jerry was saying.
That's really interesting, because human speech isn't just the words, is it? As you say, it's the intonation and the pauses, the emphasis on certain phrases, for example. So it wasn't just that you decided to say, okay, we're not going to create any new content. We're going to keep the content it is and actually, you know, make sure it's as authentic to the original tapes as possible. So what in that case, you decided not to go with re-speecher. What did you do then?
We cleaned up the audio as best we could. You know, ironically, there are now AI tools that could clean it up even better than we probably did at the time. And what I did is I decided to go with the low quality audio sort of sound that we were left with. And I used a visual aid to allow that audio to exist organically. So I put all of those clips that we created with deepfake, I put them all into period television sets, so that we filmed TV sets, so that the audio quality was already allowed to be a little bit, because you could see that it was being played out on a VHS player, or it was, you know, played out in some 1960s TV set. So we made the audio, we made the visuals, sorry, match the audio, which, you know, whether that was successful or not, you know, everybody has their own judge, but broadly nobody seemed to have an issue with it. So we just did a traditional method rather than.
So you were using Gerry Anderson's face then as a deepfake?
Yes. So we brought Gerry to screen using deepfake to say the words as a visualization tool to use the audio that we already have.
So we've seen a massive explosion since OpenAI released ChatGPT-4, which seems like a long time ago now. Yes. It's not really, is it? It's about 18 months ago or something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, GPT-4 was probably, you know, 12 months ago.
Yeah.
Probably even nearer than that.
Huge, huge explosion in development. And we've seen tantalizing clips of Sora, for example, which has got the internet buzzing.
Yep.
Obviously, that has not been released to the public yet.
No.
Will it ever get released? And interestingly, so it's difficult for us to talk in detail about how those images, those moving images, were generated, but certainly they look quite remarkable. Let's talk about AI in content production then. And as far as you're aware, what's commonly being used and maybe what isn't being used? And also, I think what's interesting is, how are the commissioners of this content approaching AI, and what's acceptable and what isn't? Or is it just, are we in the Wild West?
I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? There's a nuance to this conversation, because it's not black and white. And the main problem is the fact that nobody actually knows where the training data came from that was trained to teach all these AIs how to behave. So I think that everybody has generally accepted that where there isn't an obvious commercial benefit, and it's probably okay. You know, I think everybody, you know, needs to be aware that it's probably not great, but it's okay. I think there's a difference between developing something and then putting something out commercially, you know, available. Because development used to be a time, you know, you used to have this lovely idea of paid development, which, you know, let's face it, doesn't really exist anymore.
So maybe in drama, a little bit.
A little bit, but only if you're lucky. You know, it's certainly, you know, I know more producers who are doing development on scripted shows that are doing them unpaid than I do paid. So, you know, I think the idea of paid development largely, I think we can assume, is unpaid and therefore speculative. And so there's probably no, you know, there's no detrimental value to anybody whose data's gone into that. If you're not commercially benefiting from it, it's a little bit more research and development phase.
And the benefit of doing this is obviously saving time, isn't it?
Because yeah, of course.
It's saving time and cost, which yeah. is why people are using AI.
Well, it's certainly why they're using LLMs to sort of, you know, as initial drafts and so on. But what's really interesting is I actually had a really big pitch the other day, and I realized I couldn't actually trust the LLM to generate what I wanted it to do, because I realized that, you know, the value of it being right rather than the value of it just being okay or being right, you know, now was actually not where I needed this to be. So, you know, it was a project that was worth over $1 million, which for an unscripted feature is obviously quite a significant amount of money. So I needed that to be absolutely bang on the money, and I needed to know every word that was in there was the right word. So this further goes into the idea that just because something exists, is it the right thing to use? It's not actually just the fact that it is the answer to all your ills. It isn't, because actually sometimes you need to know everything that you're doing has come from your brain or the brain of somebody you trust. And therefore, if that fails, then at least it fails knowing that I did everything I could to do, you know, what it needed to do. So, you know, that's LLMs. If we park development for that, you then get into generative media. So images predominantly, you know, I don't think anybody's really using generative video as a development tool at the moment. And most people are creating, I say most people, that's not true. Most people I talk to, that's probably a different way, because I speak to a lot of people at panels and things who don't use generative media at all, because they don't understand it. And that's absolutely acceptable and very, very understandable. And some people just hate it. So the people that I speak to who do use generative images, they don't use them for commercial output. So, you know, it doesn't generally work out on television. They're using it as development decks, as mood boards, as stylistic choices and things. And again, it's because it gives a very good feel, whilst it may not be accurate as a representation to what they want the final frames to be like, it's good enough. It gives you an idea of where you want to go. And so there is this idea of AI being good enough, but not actually excellent. It's not ever what I'd actually put out into the world, because I wanted to have my stamp on it, because I'm a creative. So the idea that AI is going to take over the industry and take everybody's jobs away is a very passive idea. It actually puts everybody in that sort of mindscape of, ah, well, it's happened now, it's gone, I've lost my job. Whereas actually, I'm not met a creative that has ever given up. You know, we all still try, because we find new ways of doing things. So, you know, yeah, all right, don't get me wrong. I do not doubt for a minute that there will be studios looking at AI and going, oh my God, we can get rid of all the humans that are expensive. We can get rid of them all apart from three of us, and we can just take all the money and we get, you know, I don't doubt that those people exist, but they don't exist in the main. You know, I think most of us in this industry are here for a creative reason. And that's because we actually want to get hands-on and dirty and sort of look at things. And we all get very excited by really stupid things. You know, we all get very excited about, oh, that logo looks amazing that I made. None of us get excited by something that AI made. We look at it and go, yeah, that's all right. It's got an interesting potential. I wonder what I could use it for. What could I do with that?
Yeah.
Which infers that the creativity is actually with the individual. It's not what the AI can do autonomously. It's how can I leverage that AI as a tool for something that I can then create?
Well, a couple of examples, I think, that I've come across over the last couple of weeks when I was in South by Southwest, one of which was I was speaking to Marianne Carpentier from New and Studios. Fascinating, yeah. The way that they're proactively utilizing.
I spoke to her last week.
AI, yeah. Okay. And she was talking about a really good example of, they had a soap series that they were working on, and one of the actresses came down with COVID and so wasn't able to shoot the scene for at least 2 weeks. They couldn't, you know, they had to make the decision, do we take out that whole scene and take out that whole actress's work? Mm-hmm. Or can we use AI and another actress to basically deep fake and put a superimpose another the actress's face on a new actress. And in the end, they did that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole company was, she said, was quite terrified. But when they saw the result, they were amazed.
Yep.
The individuals got paid.
Yep.
So for that as an example, I thought, well, what a great absolutely use of
it's
technology.
It's a really good use of technology. And that, and that and the ability to do that has been fought for by the unions.
Yep.
You know, they, those are the deals that people have put in place and the policies that people have put in place. That isn't by accident. That is purely there because those are the things that the unions have really fought for to make sure that studios don't take advantage. So, you know, I know from policies that I've seen and been part of sort of writing over the last sort of 12 months, whatever it's been, that as long as there is consent from the relevant parties, and in this case, you know, the actor concerned, and as long as there is payment that is in line with you know, what pay should have been, then there isn't an issue. And actually, what's really interesting there is that, again, you know, actors are concerned and as I say, you know, rightly in some instances concerned about that they may lose their livelihoods and lose their jobs. Actually, AI in that instance has actually generated a job for an actor. You know, they wouldn't, you know, that body double would not have had that role previously.
That's
true.
The
scene just would have been cut.
Yeah.
So that's actually a benefit of AI.
That's a benefit. And another example was a business that I met, which was, they were in the business of creating virtual influencers. So they are AI-driven virtual influencers that live on social, but they are creating their careers as virtual influencers, and then they are recording albums or, you know, essentially building their music careers, building their acting careers.
And have you heard about the one in Spain?
I haven't heard about the one in Spain, but tell me more.
I think it only got announced today, which is that there is a... Now, I really could be misremembering the program because I only read about it on the tube on the way in. But I think it's the Spanish version of Love Island, I think, where they have removed the human presenter and they have put in a digital influencer as the presenter of the show. And that is just... it's. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but that is the kind of thing where, you know, that is where presenters... are right to be concerned, because I think that's just horrific.
Well, that's where we're getting to now, isn't it? Because there are...
Only active, if we let it be.
Well, there are active real-world examples of this coming in all over the world in very, various different territories. Some territories that are perhaps more openly accepted, like South Korea, for example. It's, you know, the, which is where the example I just mentioned comes from. Less of an issue there. And fans can interact with this virtual influencer through a trained chatbot. So they feel like they're building a relationship with them.
Whereas in reality, what they're doing is they're feeding their data into a third party for them to monetize at some later point.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, let's make two, you know, no bones about it. It's a money-making exercise. So we're seeing very different approaches to AI at the moment. And as every week and every month goes past, the new super powerful tools are becoming even more powerful as we go on. So it feels like we're a bit of an inflection point now when it comes to AI and the way it's been utilized in content creation. The benefits we've talked about, which are, you know, faster cost reductions and speed up of production, etc. The threats are there in terms of job losses, possibly in terms of what AI might trigger or where AI might go when it's being used, that, you know, not necessarily in the way that a producer or a broadcaster or the operator wants it to go. What do you think the main threats are then? If we're looking at the, you know, the benefits, we talked about that. What do you think the main threats are with AI when it comes to TV and content production?
I mean, I think there are many threats, but I think that we have to look at the threats in context. The threats are more of a threat if we're in a booming industry at the moment, which currently we're not. You know, there are more people out of work in the TV industry at the moment than I think there have been for, you know, decades. So, you know, when we talk about threats and job losses, it's difficult to see job losses where there are very few jobs in the first case, in the first instance. But that said, you know, what that implies is that, you know, that means that we're hoping that we get back to a level of employment of sort of pre-pandemic levels, if you like.
Mm, that's a big hope.
Which is a big hope. But I also think it's probably unrealistic, because what's happened now is that we've got a perfect storm where advertising revenue is down. So channels and networks can't commission to the rate that, or certainly to the expense, the level of expense that they once did. And as mentioned at the Oscars, you know, it's great to have a $100 million movie that wins all these awards, but why aren't we having more risks taken with $10 million movies that will still get people in work? And actually, we get more people in work than having these larger moves. Anyway, I mean, that is sort of one, that sort of sets the groundwork, if you like, for where we are. And then when you look at what AI can do, and what AI can do right now is that it can relight a scene in post-production. That idea of having fix it in post now has, you know, more value to it, if you like. You know, post-production workflow, the edit, having an AI assistant as an edit tool is definitely coming. I mean, I've seen a couple that are, you know, worth it. It is only a matter of time before Adobe or another has an AI assistant inbuilt into it. And that will speed up that workflow and it will lose a job. That will be a job removal. However, you can also look at it two ways, is that actually, you know, somebody who was once an edit assistant can now be an editor, because, you know, they can progress much quicker, because, you know, they most edit assistants know how to edit. You know, they've been doing it at home in their bedrooms for ages. They've just not got an opportunity to do it on a paid scale. Whereas now, anybody who comes, you know, if somebody came to me and said, right, I can now edit assist and I can put this into a timeline for you, and it'll take me 2 weeks, whereas before it would have taken six. Well, that's a job opportunity for that person. It's not necessarily a job loss for somebody else. It's a job opportunity for that person. So I think the way that AI is working at the moment is because it is making things cheaper, it means that people can take more risks. And when you can take more risks, you can get more work done. And so the industry will, you know, the industry always survives. It always has done. You know, I forget exactly what the number is. It's something like 60% of the workforce in TV today are in jobs that didn't exist 40 years ago. And the same is likely to be true, you know, in 40 years time and so on. You know, to give you an idea, we are a small production company. We've got, I think, a core team of five. We're going to expand on that five by hiring a software developer. So that is a software developer that would never have worked in television prior to AI becoming a thing. But now it is a job that we need, because there are certain tools that we need for the productions that we are developing that we can't do unless we hire a software developer.
And this would be utilizing AI to create your own AI-driven tools.
Well, yeah, that's right. So, I mean, the thing that I don't think a number of people recognize about AI is the fact that it is an open source tool. In the same way as Elon Musk, everybody's favorite villain, decided to give away the patents to everlasting batteries, if you like, sort of what he was doing. Because, you know, that then is out there for everybody to develop tools and to actually improve the market. And AI is just an open source tool. So that means that unless you've got, you know, some really precious data that nobody else has got, everybody can do what, you know, okay, I was going to say everybody can do what Sam Altman at OpenAI can. That's maybe not necessarily true because of the financial backing he's got. But on a smaller scale, we can all create these tools. Large language models, we can all create them. You know, but we can create them for specific purposes. And that's what people kind of are missing, I think, at the moment, is to look at a problem and go, right, what tool can I now create that fixes that? Or that allows me to present this idea in a totally new way. How can I look? And these are things that we can all do. We just have to look at the problem slightly differently. And that's the bit that, you know, people don't get. And they don't get it, and that's completely understandable. And that's why people like me exist at the moment, because I, you know, and that's how I get booked on a lot of things, because actually I sort of make people aware of the fact that there are lots and lots of opportunities with AI that don't result in everybody losing their job. It's about taking another tool and providing an experience that could not have been provided without AI being able to manipulate data in the way that it currently can. And you know, and I feel it's obviously very, very important at this point to sort of put in that caveat that says that all the data that you get needs to be ethically sourced. You know, we can't be stealing data from people who, you know, and by data, I do mean people's hard work, you know, creative programs, we get, you know, paintings or photographs or films or documentary content or what have you. It's all, you know, to the individuals who created them, they all have value. They all have intrinsic value, and they all have the ability, more importantly for a lot of them, to generate their income and, you know, secure their financial sort of position as they go into later life. We can't be stealing that. And I will be the first to say that I will not use a Midjourney, a Runway, a Stable Diffusion in any of the productions that I use. There will be no content that comes, you know, from me that appears on screen. And you know, and I think that the work that PACT is doing in the guidelines that will come through, they should be released any day now. The statement from PACT and from Equity when that comes, and there will be others. They all recognize the value of human input and the value of copyright. We can't be traipsing all over that. You know, I recognize that there will come a point, if it has not already been said, and I think it might have been, there may well be a point where we sort of have to accept that we can choose whether or not we use that. Now, when Getty launches their Runway partnership platform, that will only, you know, that Runway Getty video creation site will have only been trained on Getty video. So that becomes okay to use because everybody in that content partnership program gets paid.
And it becomes an industry standard, doesn't it, I suppose, yeah, at that point.
Yeah. And that is where, you know, whether it's Getty or whether it's any other provider, when they, you know, when they move down that route, that's great because everybody benefits. But we can't have a system that just steals other people's work and says it's okay.
I mean, it must be a huge attraction and temptation for a producer. We talked about, you know, the difficulties that producers have got at the moment in terms of the existing model of TV production is broken, basically, at the moment.
Yeah.
And it needs to be fixed in some way. I suspect it's just going to be a lot smaller industry with funding coming from lots of other places outside of traditional networks. But if you're a producer right now and you're struggling to survive,
yeah,
and you're working on a production and you can see a way to save $5,000 or $10,000 by using a Midjourney or any of these other tools, you can do it, aren't you?
I mean, the question is, who's going to commission it?
Well, if it's already been commissioned, I mean, that's an interesting question. So let's go on to the ultimate commissioners at the moment, who are paying for the content and have lots of checks that go yeah, through on all the content that we see on our TV screens and our devices. There's no industry standard right now to pick up necessarily. So if I'm a producer who's saved $5,000 by using Midjourney, I finish my production, I send it to the network for delivery and they look at it. And at the moment, they may not have any tools that they run that through, AI-driven tools that can actually detect whether this AI being used. So we may all already be seeing content going out that's using AI that maybe the network wasn't aware of.
Yep.
Do you suspect that is going on right now?
I know of some production companies who use some level of generative AI. I mean, I think we're all aware of, you know, generative fill, I suppose, that has, you know, that has been a thing that we've all kind of used in one way or another over the last 5 years, you know, of being able to touch up Photoshop and remove people from backgrounds and things.
Okay, yeah, and extend backgrounds.
And extend backgrounds and so on. You know, that is something that I don't think there's ever really been a problem with, because it's always been human-led, if you like. As soon as we bring AI into the mix, as soon as you use the word AI, everybody's heckles go up. You sort of go, no, I don't like that. You know, but actually the ability to turn vertical pictures into horizontal pictures, you know, 9:16 into 16:9, that could well be things that people are using. Does that mean, you know, is that a bad thing? I don't know. I think there's an interesting idea of intended use that we need to look at in there, which is that as long as you're not intrinsically changing the intended use of the item that you're working with. There's certainly, I would be very, very surprised if anybody is using a generative video at the moment, because certainly nothing I've seen comes close to being usable at the moment. But there may well be cases of there being generative images being used on screen.
Yeah, I mean, my thought goes to a car scene when you're actually inside a car and the location outside the car is often shot. There are companies now that specialize in obviously shooting that and sending a car around LA, for example, and that then being pieced around the final film. Now we're seeing virtual production, which you can imagine AI being utilized into virtual production much more seamlessly.
Absolutely. I mean, I do agree. You know, B-roll is where generative video is going to do very well. And, you know, I do accept that there are probably going to be points where, you know, generative video gets used for that. But again, I couldn't really point at any at the moment where you'd confidently be able to use generative video. I've not seen any that's really that good or doesn't have. It's the consistency that generative video doesn't really have. It can't, you know, track an object particularly well over a series of frames, which is obviously where, you know, Sora then came in and said, "Hi, look at me. I'm very exciting." And it said it in just that voice as well.
Yes.
And I think that was a game changer, because it suddenly showed the potential. But there are a couple of very, very curious things about Sora. One is the timing, which I believe purely coincidentally turned up at the same time as a funding round for OpenAI. I'm sure that's a coincidence. And the other thing is the fact that there was a guy who, I think the famous clip, if you like, the famous clip of Sora at the moment is the Asian lady walking through Japan. It's raining, there's puddles on the street, there's lots of lights. And they uploaded that video to YouTube, and it generated a copyright strike, which meant that, and it wasn't a copyright strike that was generated by OpenAI. It was a copyright strike generated by a third party. Now, if you know anything about copyright strikes on YouTube, that means that there is another video somewhere within YouTube's library that it is able to reference and recognize as pre-existing. So I'm not saying that you know, because I don't know, and I don't know the circumstances, and I am just, you know, repeating what somebody said online, and that's always quite difficult. But I watched the video about it, and I looked at it, and I made my own mind up, and it did seem to have a level of genuine authenticity to it. And so it begs the question, has that clip been put out because they knew it was going to work? Because the prompt that they wrote was written in order to coincide with a piece of training data that they knew was already in the system. And they wrote, how many times did they have to write that prompt out using which words in order to generate that clip that was as good as it was? And when they looked at the other 9 clips that they put out, brilliant as they all were in terms of, you know, actual video, you know, absolutely, you know, as an improvement, they're brilliant. But actually, what's to say they weren't, you know, the one of the dogs? What's to say that the prompt wasn't generated in such a way that it was absolutely guaranteed to replicate a video that was already in it? Again, not saying that that is what they did. I've got no proof of that thing, but it made me question what you're looking at. So can we trust everything we see on the internet? Oh, crazy idea. I'd say possibly not. You only really know how these things work once you get in and you work with them. You know, I think the ability to move the camera in runway, as an example, is a brilliant example of the fact that, you know, actually it's not as straightforward as they like to make it look. You do need to understand runway in order to get the camera movements looking as smooth as they need to, or people looking in the way that they make them look, which in turn tells you that AI is not about to steal your job. What you're going to do is you're going to, if you want to use an AI system like an ethical runway, probably Getty's, you're going to have to learn the system.
Yeah, you have to be trained yourself.
You have to be trained in that program in the same way as you have to be trained in, you know, any of the other myriad of programs that we bits of software that we all have to be trained in TV.
Yeah.
So it's not as straightforward as people think it is.
No, it's not. I've gone in and tried my hand at a number of these different tools. Some are completely intuitive, great.
Yeah.
Others, the rise of the prompt engineer as a job, I can see that is required, because I'll write something and go, oh, I want to see, I don't know, a dog running along a road at sunset, and because I'm not using the right terminology in the right way, in the right order, and the right camera frame and terminology.
But actually, that's it. That goes even further, then, doesn't it? Is that, you know, some of these prompts are so clever that they can work out different lenses.
Yeah.
Now, the only way you know about lenses is if you've actually shot something.
Yeah.
So, you know, so this is more of the rise of the VFX community. This is something else that they can build into their armory. You know, in the same way as if I write something in ChatGPT and say, right, I'd like to translate this into Japanese. Now, imagine if I was doing a pitch to a Japanese, I don't know why I've picked a Japanese broadcaster, it's a very bad example. But actually, I've written a brilliant pitch in English and I've told it to translate it. Am I going to deliver that document straight out of ChatGPT to the head of broadcasting? So, no, of course I'm not. I'm going to hand it to somebody who knows what they're doing and knows whether or not that translation accurately represents what I'm trying to say. Yeah. It might say it word for word, but actually there might be nuances in there that are completely incorrect. So it needs to be enveloped into a system that already knows what it's talking about. And it needs to be something that producers can rely on and that there's trust there. And that I think is something that, you know, that people are getting, they're just getting a bit lost with at the moment.
Yeah. And just coming on to a point that we talked about earlier on is networks. So at the moment, none of the commissioning networks, or not as far as we know, that there's certainly no industry-wide agreement on how generative AI is being used in terms of content creation.
Yeah. There are some networks that have, or sorry, there is one network that has put out its guidelines now.
Right.
Okay. So BBC now has AI guidelines.
Right.
That are, you know, it's a fairly lengthy document, and when you read it, it most of it makes sense. Some of it, I think, the wording has been, I'm not going to say it's been thrown together, because everybody's working very, very hard to get it right, but some of it is perhaps not written using the language that you would expect, I think, you know, and so is a little bit too open for interpretation or could be misconstrued. And actually, the BBC, I think, at one stage have said that none of their programs use any AI, whereas that doesn't actually take into account any of the, you know, any of the levels of Photoshop that have ever used in any of their productions, or it doesn't, you know, it's that sort of very black and white thing. But no, we don't use AI. Well, you kind of have. You know, but don't worry about it. It's those nuance of conversations that are important. But certainly there is no industry blanket. There's no standard. Yeah.
So regulation then. So there's lots of different regulation going through various different governmental levels at the moment. I think the US has just passed some laws in the Senate there. The EU as well has just, I think a couple of weeks ago, also passed something. Yeah. So we are starting to see the lawmakers close a few loopholes, I think. It's a bit late, though, isn't it? And it's not going at the same speed as generative AI.
Well, it's not even that. It's the fact that, we're obviously referring to this in a TV sense. And yeah, you're right. You know, there is legislation that's been passed in the EU. There is legislation that's been passed in...
But it's blanket, isn't it?
Well, it's delving at high level and general and low risk. And as far as EU legislation goes, generative media for TV is low risk. There's no... So they've just gone, meh, it's all right. We'll leave it. It's fine. You know, I think copyright's in there, but that's about it. You know, anything else you can do what you want. Just don't get it wrong. And that's, you know, it's a bit like sort of being the third child and just go, oh, they're playing in the road. Yeah, well, don't play. The motorway's a bad one to play on, but the others are all right. Just be fine. Yeah, it's all right. Whereas when you start looking at military contracts, they do start being a little bit more specific over what's allowed and what isn't allowed. So once again, it is up to the TV community, the production community, to look after itself and make sure that we put the guidelines in that safeguard ourselves and the future of our industry. So we can't rely on EU legislation or you know, if you're a massive Brexit fan, you know, British legislation's even further behind. So let's not wait for that. And in the US, it's just as bad.
So this leads us on to the AI certification scheme that you've been working on.
I think working on is possibly a little bit further down the line. I've presented the idea of a certification scheme, and I've presented the idea to John at PACT and to Liam and a couple of other guys at Equity, and I'm talking to BAFTA about it tomorrow. And there is a reception to that is very positive. I think it would be incorrect to suggest that we're having, you know, that we're in the middle of in-depth discussions about it. But what we are all agreed on, Equity, PACT and BAFTA, is that a scheme like that might well be something that works. Because in much the same way as the Albert scheme, I'm going to preface this by saying that the Albert scheme obviously has a financial element at the end of it. I'm trying to get to a point where we don't have a financial, you know, incentive to pay into the, you know, whatever this AI scheme is, because the industry is under enough trouble as it is. It doesn't need to be paying out more things. But the idea of having a level of certification that clearly states what is and what isn't allowed on TV, you know, the BBC have clearly done a good start with their guidelines that says what we expect from our producers. I don't think it quite says you cannot do this. I need to be, you know, slightly more careful about my wording on that one. But having a blanket certification scheme like Albert that people sort of buy into in a non-financial sense, I think is something that could really work, that says, you know, you will not have used any generative media here where, you know, the copyright isn't clear. Or, you know, you don't have consent from the voice actor for your voice synthesis. You have not cloned anybody's voice, you know, without their permission. That kind of, you know, low level stuff. You know, you've used human script writers. You know, you've not done X, Y, and Z.
And to your point earlier on, many of these tools are available as open source. So there might be a time when there is almost like a check, which is an AI-driven tool that you can check every piece of content that comes into a network. That's the first thing they do, is just run it through.
Well, it becomes part of your QC, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, same as you run a QC for everything these days anyway. And there, you know, there is software available already that can detect deepfakes and it can detect X, Y, and Z. But currently, there's no single point of contact for that. Whereas if the, you know, what we're developing, this idea of you know, the scheme, where there is a single point where you run it through almost exactly as you suggest, and you know, it detects X, Y, and Z. But also, I think the industry is interested in safeguarding itself. You know, we're in a really, really fortunate position at Deep Fusion Films, very, very fortunate, because we're at the head of this, you know, this movement at the moment to sort of understand AI and where it sits. It does mean that I'm having a lot of conversations with a lot of different production companies. I mean, since I came back from Real Screen, you know, wherever that was that a month, over a month?
Yeah.
I think I've probably had three or four meetings with different production companies every single week since I've been back. And everybody is interested in the same conversation, which is, right, we want to be able to harness AI, but we also don't want to mess up the industry in the process. You know, I want to safeguard jobs. And there was one meeting I was in a couple of weeks ago where somebody in the meeting brought up B-roll and oh, could we do this with whatever platform they wanted to mention? And I said, right, well, you know, yeah, theoretically in 6 months, we probably can do that. I said, but actually, you know, do we want to do that? Because that means that we are actively saying we don't value the input of, you know, a cameraman who is able to shoot these scenes for us. And we didn't even discuss it for more than 5 seconds. It was an instant, no, you're right. No, we don't need, that doesn't enhance the product. AI does not enhance the production in that way. Having a human creative does enhance it because it puts somebody in a job. We're all much more finely tuned now to the delicate balance of the industry. And whilst there will be, as we said earlier, studio execs who are, you know, rubbing their hands and going, yes, this is a way of, you know, making all the money for ourselves. Actually, the people who are making the programs, the people we're talking about putting out of work, they're our friends. They're people we've worked with for the past 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years. We don't want to see them out of work. We want to, you know, the idea of TV being a creative and collaborative process involves being around people who you can share ideas with and share your creative collaboration with. And you absolutely cannot get rid of those because no program is ever autonomous. You know, a producer's job, a creator's job, a director's job is to funnel, you know, creativity into a final product. You don't ever have anybody who just stands at, well, no, that's not true. There are directors, obviously, who go, yeah, it's my way or the highway. But they don't tend to last very long. You know, you work with the team and every member of that team, and we can include actors in this. I mean, we haven't even touched on actors and the value they bring to a production. You know, the way that unit moves is it's an extension of theatre, isn't it? I mean, my background was theatre. I was a theatre actor before I was a theatre director and a writer, and then I moved into television. And the idea of collaboration in theatre is you know, that is the thing. You know, you the idea of showmance, and you fall in love with all the members of your cast and company, and you idolize everything they do. And that moves into TV as well, except obviously in scripted television, those teams are so big, but you know, you get the same feeling within different departments. You can't get rid of those because the value, the intrinsic value they bring to the screen.
How about animation?
See, animation's interesting. Because that is a different, it is a different process, and it can be more, you know, solo led, if you like, you know, it really can. But animation doesn't create itself, and AI doesn't create itself, which goes back to the idea of AI being a tool to use rather than, you know. So let's look at, I don't know if anybody watched the making of Frozen. I mean, I'm not going to say it's the best documentary I've ever watched, but I did at the time have a 6-year-old girl who absolutely wanted to watch it. So therefore I watched it. And watching the animation processes of, you know, of what the animators did at that level to, I think there was a moment where Elsa runs up to the top of a cliff and she's singing, you know, whatever the song was. The one that isn't Let It Go, the other one. You can sing it later, Justin, that'll be fine.
It's in my head.
It is,
I'm not
yes.
going to subject anybody to
but
that.
But there was, so the animator didn't know, she was having real problems trying to work out the run and the slide up to the edge of the cliff. So she filmed herself running and sliding up to the edge of the cliff. Now, as you know, anybody who's looked at sort of Runway in the early iterations of Runway, there was the guy who filmed himself walking through, you know, various rooms, and he did himself as a Roman, and then he transformed into, you know, a pigeon or whatever it was. It probably wasn't a pigeon, that wouldn't have made much sense. But that process was a process generated, you know, that was created with AI. Now, what the animator in Frozen did was that she then hand drew over the, you know, the movements that she filmed on camera, and then turned herself into Elsa. And there is that section of that film that is her running up to the edge of the thing, you know, albeit now as Elsa. But that process is complementary. You know, it's time effective, if you like, which I'm pretty sure isn't a phrase, but we've made it up. You know, that is a good use of time and saves that process, which means that the filmmaking becomes slightly cheaper, which then means what else can you do with that money? What can we hire in? Who can we hire in? And so I think that animation is definitely somewhere where AI can be used as a tool, but it's not autonomous. It can't, you know, I think somebody said to me, and it was absolutely right. Somebody said to me the other day, you know, yes, but it's only ever reiterative. It only ever learns what was gone into it. It's never innovative. The content it creates is not innovative. The people who write the prompts are innovative. And I think that's the crux of it. You could feed an LLM all the scripts of, you know, Star Wars, and it would come up with another Star Wars, but it wouldn't have come up with Star Wars in the first place. So it will only ever know from what it was in, you know, what it's fed with. You need somebody to build those prompts to start with in order to make it innovative. And that, I think, is probably the most crucial thing to learn about AI.
And now it's time for Story of the Week, where Ben gets to choose the TV industry news story that's caught his eye in the past 7 days. Ben, what's your story of the week?
It's the fact that Ofcom has finally woken up to the idea that GB News might not be impartial. So who'd have thought? I mean, I just would never have guessed that.
Extraordinary.
Isn't it? You know, at the point that they hired 5 MPs to present their shows, and they all happened to be Tory MPs. I'm sure that was just by accident. I'm sure they were just the ones that were available at the time, you know, with their second jobs instead of running a country. Yeah, I was just absolutely amazed that, frankly, it's taken this long for Ofcom to go, yeah, I don't think this is entirely right. But what amazed me even more than that was the fact that they've said, but this is your first offence, so I'll let you off. So first offence? what level of... What else do they need to do? I can't believe it. I mean, it's so wrapped up in red tape, isn't it?
Well, I think they're getting in early before the election, but I'm sure that's something we're going to see more and more.
Well, with any luck, you see, all of these Tory MPs will need a job shortly. Yeah. And then, you know, I can't quite believe that GB News still just exists. I can't believe it was allowed to exist in the first place. I think everybody saw what that was going to do, didn't we? Didn't everybody? It had 500 complaints last week for one show. And there are two things that astound me with that. One is that the people who are watching GB News are the people who thought that they'd then like to complain about it, which means that they're not hardcore GB News fans, which means that people actually watch GB News for the content, which is just, I don't know if that's more remarkable than, because I think I have an idea of the type of person who watches GB News, and maybe that's a bad thing. I know it's a bad thing because obviously that means that it's my little bigoted brain. but at the same time, you know, God, we all know.
All right. Okay.
You've stayed very quiet there. Well, very on the fence there. The perfect podcast host.
I have to be balanced, I think.
Why? GB News can't be bothered. Why do you have to
be? This is true. Well, you know, and Talk TV, that's gone the way of many other networks, hasn't it?
Oh, has it? Oh, that's a real shame.
Yeah.
I'm very, very disappointed.
Interestingly, going to be digital first now. Especially Piers Morgan's show as well. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. People can tell him they hate him directly then, can't they? It's much nicer. He likes a bit of feedback. I think there's always disappointing times where you know, Piers Morgan says something and I agree with it and I go, oh God, you know. But a stopped watch is right twice a day, isn't it? So
that's how we get to you.
Yeah.
And now it's time for Hero of the Week. Ben, who's your hero?
Oh, it's John at PACT. John's done an amazing job recently. And I know he got a real backlash, actually, after the 40% tax credit films in the UK. And LinkedIn gave him a bit of a hard time because there was a bit of a backlash over, you know, oh, that's all great for scripted, but what about unscripted? So, well, you know, films, unscripted or documentary features are included in that. In that wonderful sort of level of tax incentive that's there. And that has actively sort of brought, I think, two shows to us that we couldn't have done before, or certainly, you know, we wouldn't have jumped on as quickly as we now have. And as a particular, you know, as an unscripted production company, predominantly, we do have scripted stuff in the works, but naturally that takes much longer. You know, if we can find two within 2 weeks, then it kind of suggests that actually, you know, there's nothing really to complain about. You know, the state of the unscripted industry is a thing to be very concerned about, but it's not PACT's job to fix that, you know, unilaterally. You know, there are probably conversations ongoing that the guys and girls at PACT are having that are wonderful and really beneficial for the unscripted industry. But what's happening is unscripted is pretty much unprecedented. So trying to find a way through it and trying to find a quick fix to any of those, it's not like PACT can tell all the networks to start, you know, paying out where there isn't any money. But what they have managed to do is they have managed to, you know, find this way of incentivizing talent to stay in the UK and make films in the UK. And that's across scripted and unscripted. And I think that's really, really valuable. And I know, you know, I know that John has personally worked very, very hard on that, as have many of the other team at PACT. But I know that John particularly has had fingers pointed at him over the last couple of weeks. And I think that's probably been a little undeserved. So I would like to praise him as hero of the week.
John is hero of the week. We'll have to get John back on the show soon to have a bit of a catch up. It'd be great to speak to him about this and many of the other issues that are facing producers in the UK right now. And finally, who or what are you telling to get in the bin?
You see, this is the problem, is the fact that I don't know who to put in the bin or what to put in the bin. People who used unlicensed AI software can get in the bin. Right. You know, steal content, steal copyright. That's probably a really, really good one. I think, you know, Sam Altman can probably get in the bin. You know, he misled, and I whether he actively misled or whether he went on an R&D journey and he said, yeah, actually it'd be great to sort of set this AI up, but I can't quite believe that he wasn't commercially minded at the back end of it all. And so what started out for him as apparently a scientific experiment, he then realized he needed to monetize quite quickly, and so did all of his investors. So anybody who did that and knowingly stole people's content and tried to find a way of monetizing it can get in the bin. And now I think about it, actually, OpenAI's CTO, Chief Technology Officer, who went in an interview the other week and openly admitted she didn't know where any of OpenAI's data was trained on. And in that interview also said, or basically also admitted that actually all the YouTube content was probably included in the data training. Yeah, she can get in the bin because that is completely unethical. So let's put her in the bin first and Sam can follow.
Right, you are. Double binage. Ben, thank you so much for coming on Telecast. Really fascinating to talk about the ethics and all these other issues that are raised with the generative AI and the speed of which this is presenting opportunities, but also issues for the content industry. So thanks again for coming on Telecast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Telecast was produced by Spirit Studios and recorded in London. Next week, we'll be rounding up the latest AI-powered tools we discovered at South by Southwest, so don't miss that. And don't forget to subscribe to Telecast on YouTube. You can find a link on the episode description or just search for Telecast TV on YouTube and hit subscribe. Until next week, stay safe.